Let's get started.
Hey, it's Tuesday, which means Taking It Down is back with you. We've got some pop culture thoughts brewing, which is great since we're a pop culture discussion podcast. Today, Donovan and I are talking about the Netflix biographical documentary Dick Johnson is Dead from Kirsten Johnson. And then after the break, Adam's going to join me, and he and I will discuss the Apple TV show Ted Lasso, which stars SNL alum Jason Sudeikis. As always, there's a lot more pop culture goings on over at the website, The Alabama Take, as well as some sports takes and political takes. The Alabama Take is the producer of our show. And coming up on October 27th, just in time for Halloween, it's the book club episode for The Only Good Indians. That's the name of the book from author Stephen Graham Jones. Donovan, Adam, and I will discuss that. But let's get Donovan in here. It's one of our co-hosts. And
hello.
Very gentle intro, huh? It's just you and I are here to talk predominantly about Dick Johnson is Dead, but it would be unlike us not to mention the world we live in, which is COVID.
I think that every bowl game this year should be sponsored by COVID, and everyone should legally be referred to as the COVID Bowl. Marshall versus App State, COVID Bowl 2020.
Well, let's tie those things together, honestly. I did not think we'd get this far in the football season. I didn't think we'd get this far with school.
I didn't either. It could still be coming.
That's true. But we got much further than I would have thought.
Agreed.
We at our school, my school, where I teach, we've made it to fall break. So we made it the first 9 weeks with no huge incidents, I guess.
So things are starting to get a little chilly up here, right?
Yeah.
Which doesn't help. Cold and flu, we're in our flu season now. A couple schools near us are having some big outbreaks. One was exact. So in my town, God, this is just, if you want to just, this tie, call, let me call back to Immigration Nation. So there are a good chunk of families in my town that are undocumented. And the school system is having an outbreak. And ICE has let it be known that, you know, they may be doing some more raids. And so these immigrant advocacy groups have told people like, hey, be ready. ICE could be coming. You know what to do. Have your paper, all this stuff. Well, because there's an outbreak right now, we need contact tracers, right? But people aren't answering their doors. People aren't sending their kids to school, right? Because ICE will pick you up when you're trying to get your kid. It's making it really hard to track. And, you know, people still have to go out and shop. So it's making the community spread worse because these people are legitimately afraid. And I think it really comes back to the question of what's our purpose here? What are we doing here?
Yeah, exactly. No, that's exactly what I was going to say. I was going to also say that that's just one of the many flaws of ICE, that those kinds of problems start to unravel, to pile up, I guess is a better.
Absolutely. So anyway. It's kind of interesting, right? How sometimes everyone's being good and we'll see what happens with cold and flu season. But at the same time, we can't, everything about the world we live in makes dealing with this outbreak just harder than it should be.
And hopefully, you know, the sensible of us will continue to wear masks, and that might limit flu. And
holy smokes, like all the football games this season have seemed so weird. Everyone is just a gift.
Yes.
Like Mizzou doing a goal line stand to knock down LSU. Thank you, Jesus. Florida giving it all away.
Yes. And I thought we were going to get something like that from Bama, which, the three of us on the show are noted Bama fans and alum.
All I could think about with that game last night is, you know, in The Princess Bride, there's that machine that takes years off your life.
For sure.
They turned it up to 50 last night.
And I'll go ahead and say it. You know, this is going to get, with everything online on Twitter, you got one side that builds, and then you get the blowback from that side, and then you get people pissed off at the blowback people. So I am firmly rooted in the fire, Pete Golding. I say do it this week. Just do it. Put Charlie Strong in the slot. You're good.
Whatever the heck happened last night during the Bama game was just, what was going on? Our defense looked lost. They look confused out there. And then I was telling Blaine, there seemed some points where, like, you know, an Ole Miss player would get out into the open, and they'd be like, Okay, well, guess we're not gonna wear ourselves out. That's a touchdown. Yeah. And, you know, I really don't blame the players for that at all. We have great players. We've seen them do great things. We've had three games of terrible defense. Just terrible. I didn't sign up to cheer for TCU, Blaine. I want to cheer for Bama.
Yeah, you said it was like a Big 12 game and it was...
We're just, you know, each one of those games where it's like, I mean, it was like watching, you know, Oklahoma when they were fun with Baker Mayfield or Kyler Murray or even Jalen Hurts last year, where it's like, Okay, they're going to score on every possession. And basically you're just hoping your defense gets lucky. And that's ridiculous. We can't beat, Georgia's looking like it could be kind of scary this year. And even, there's some rumbling, you know, if we goof around, like Tennessee hung on with Georgia for a whole half of the game. If we goof around, we're not going to be in a good place.
My next point was Tennessee is not an awful team like usual.
Yeah. No, they did end up, like, Georgia really pulled away at the end, but Tennessee hung on. First off, they had a very funny first score. Secondly, I mean, you know, they're recruiting, you know, same as we are. That's the glory of the SEC, right? You can't sleepwalk through it. And we've seen those years that Bama has kind of sleepwalked through it, and it always ends up with something incredible happening at the Iron Bowl. So there you go.
You and I have both listened to the Drive-By Truckers new album.
Well, yeah.
Let's briefly talk about that. Let me rephrase this. I've listened to the majority of it, and I really want to sit with it, but I have listened to a lot of this album.
It is a short one for them, especially for them, where I feel like most of their albums hit the hour mark, usually. Maybe I'm wrong with that, but this one's really... I want to say it's on the 20-minute side of the 30-minute mark, but it's around 30 minutes long.
It's 36 minutes.
Was it? Okay, so it's pretty short.
On the dot.
And this was a surprise release. They had said, basically, we feel horrible all the time, so we might as well make music.
And they talked about how, for the tracks that weren't already recorded and in the can from previous session, that they had, I think Pat Patterson had written some things and sent it to the drummer, Brad, and he would lay down. And then they'd just basically send it to each other. And Mike Cooley mentioned in a Rolling Stone interview that he enjoyed that process because it gave him a lot more time to dwell on what he wanted to play for each part. And I was curious, do you hear that?
I think maybe a little, like, for whatever reason, you know, like, these guys cannot sound anything like, they cannot sound anything other than themselves, right? Like, the Drive-By Truckers sound like the Drive-By Truckers at this point.
Yeah.
And they're all, you know, but at the same time, I did feel like there was a little, like, these songs just felt different to me. Not in a way that I could put my finger on. And I was just assuming that that was a result of the way they were made. Cause I don't think I could sit down and say, this is exactly the reason that I think these sound, but I'm even thinking of like, and it may be just the way their band is going, but, I did feel like it was more in tune with the last album, which my brain keeps wanting to call it Ashes of American Flags, but it has an American flag on it.
American band.
Thank you. And
but the album, they even have an album this year, which is The Unraveling, and then the one we're talking about is the new OK.
Yeah, we're on the new OK. I think, and part of this may be, you know, Patterson moving out to wherever he moved out in Oregon. I think the last one that really sounded like a more classic Truckers album to me was English Ocean. So it may be
fantastic album.
It's a great album. Maybe it's just the band's moving in a little different direction. Maybe it's the way that they're writing and talking about now. I don't know. It felt a little, I mean, at their best, right? They always sound like a bunch of guys just jamming in a room together.
You're right. And they weren't for this. There were a few, I think, that were in the can already, but
yeah.
I think this one's notable for a couple of reasons. Matt Patton sings two songs.
Yep.
He sings The Unraveling, which was the title of the last album, but we're talking about the song, The Unraveling. Yeah. And then
when I saw that, I was like, wait, was this on the last album? And I wonder if they had it, they wanted to put it on the last album or something, and it just didn't fit. Because that seemed very odd, right?
That seems like the case. They released the song, The Unraveling, a few months ago for Record Store Day. And I think.
Okay. That makes sense because Record Store Day has passed me by this year, I hate to say.
I think the B-side was Sarah's Flame.
Okay.
Which also on this album.
That was a standout, I thought. You know, they're all good. I got to say, I think the lyrics on this one are great.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, Matt, I thought you did great. I'm sure he's listening. We all know so. He's listening. But yeah. I was actually kind of excited because I was wondering if we'd get some Matt Patton contributions eventually.
Yeah.
Just because of, you know, that seems to be the way they like to do it. So I thought that was awesome.
And Matt is he fronted his own band for years.
Oh yeah,
Model Citizen down in Alabama and Tuscaloosa specifically for the most part, and you know. It was an amazing guitar. He plays great guitar.
Yes, he does.
And he plays great bass. Like, you know, he's equally talented on those things. And he ends the album with the Ramones cover, The KKK Took My Baby Away, which is also pretty fitting for this time, isn't it?
I did like that one quite a bit.
I did too. It was a good cover, pretty, you know, stuck to the original, but it was still Truckers, you know. It was half Truckers, half Ramones, and it felt good.
Did you ever hear their, it's a long cover, and it's on, I want to say this was a Record Store Day exclusive, when it's the album that, Go-Go Boots, when Go-Go Boots came out.
Mm-hmm.
They had some live shows, they had some alternate takes of Used to Be a Cop, and they finished it with a cover of Buttholeville going, or so Buttholeville's their song, but sliding into
Springsteen.
State Trooper. Yeah. And that was like,
yeah,
it was Truckers. It was Springsteen.
I saw them on that tour, I guess. May have been the last time I saw them. No, maybe. Maybe English Ocean's tour. I saw them. Of course, they constantly tour when things are all right. The last time I saw them, Matt was definitely with them. So I'm just trying to figure out. But it doesn't matter. That's not important. But I did see them do that version where Patterson pulled in the Springsteen song, as a mishmash of.
I did the album, which is also Go-Go Boots, if I remember correctly, you know, they kind of built it around two covers, and that was kind of what they were playing on, you know, Letterman or whatever. And they're fine. I didn't love them. I actually think they're almost always my skippers on that album because I think there's some really strong songs. But man, I kind of hearing them when they really do a cover, they really do it well.
Yeah,
I kind of wish I'd hear some more out of them.
They've got a good cover of "Rebels" by Tom Petty.
Yep,
they've got a pretty good cover of "Like a Rolling Stone" from Dylan.
I have not heard that one.
Yeah, it was back when they had their previous bass player, and everyone took a verse.
Okay,
it might even be Isbell in there. It might even be that old, but I.
So that was when they had Shauna Tucker with them.
That's right, and everyone took a verse of "Like a Rolling Stone," so it was enough for everybody to sing a verse. So it might even be Jason Isbell in there, but don't quote me on that. It's on Spotify though. It's on a rarities kind of album or a B-sides album, I think. But the new OK is 9 songs long, and you seem hesitant on this one. Are you? Do you? Is it that you just can't wrap your head around its purpose, or are you?
I think I gotta listen to it a few more times because on my first listen through, I thought, you know, this is good, but also I hate to say it, my initial thought was this is kind of slight, and I don't know why I felt that way, and that was kind of what I was wondering if I felt that way because it was not made together in the same way that they usually work. I wonder if that was it. Because there's some, you know, I listened to the songs a couple times through. They're one of my favorite bands. I was really excited. The lyrics are really good. You know, that I loved, you know, I felt like, I do kind of feel like it was a little restrained until until the end. Until they did their cover of KKK Took My Baby Away. Maybe that's just, you know, these are all just first impressions. I think when I listen to it again, I'm going to hear things. I always hear things I didn't hear before with them.
You know, it's funny, The Unraveling, which came out earlier this year, is only 9 songs long and 42 minutes long. So,
yeah.
But that is I thought that was a great album. The Unraveling is a fantastic album. And I do think I'm going to really like the new OK pretty well.
Also,
that's where I think my head's going with this one.
Part of it too is I do think there was a little bit of when I was listening to it, it's like just, and this is not a good fit. This is not a good reaction, but just like, man, I'm sick of this shit. not the drive-by truckers, just, and I think it's, I think it's awesome how explicitly their albums have been confronting, especially white supremacy and the mm-hmm. legacy of white supremacy in America. But also, you know, sometimes when you're listening to music, you're almost like, I just need a break.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, for so sure. I wonder if there was a little bit. I do have to say, I think that, and this is maybe even a whole show or another conversation, but the way the truckers have on their last, I guess, three albums now, you know, they've made, I think, a while back the decision that they're not going to play Southern Thing anymore at their shows because mm-hmm. Folks were, you know, kind of taking it the wrong way. And the way that they have really decided that they don't do the Southern apologetics anymore, really. Mm-hmm. It's been an interesting turn. And I feel like that's kind of more the same on this one.
All right. Well, I've got a real quick question for you, maybe.
Yes.
We'll talk about it, though. The wife and I have recently started Netflix show The Haunting of Bly Manor, which is a continuation or another piece of the Haunting series, I think is how they're going to tackle it. So 2 years ago, it was The Haunting of Hill House. And did you end up watching that at all?
I did.
Okay.
I liked it a lot.
Yeah, I did too.
Except for the last 30 minutes, just like everyone else.
Yeah, I thought the last 30 minutes were acceptable at best, I think. But
I thought that it was, you know, endings are hard. So unless you
in
really.
Horror, especially.
Unless you, and they had some of the best, like, horror TV episodes I've ever seen. The Bent Neck Lady is a classic, right? The episode where we find that one out. Which I guess I was reading. Is it Mike Flanagan is the director? I believe
that's
it's
him, writer director.
Yeah. So Mike Flanagan, you know, said that the scene at so one of the things I really liked about this the Haunting of Hill House was that it had lots of cool camera tricks, but they never seemed to be flashy for flashiness' sake. Yeah. So we had like the scene in the funeral home where it was all one take, yes, pretty much. And I guess Mike Flanagan was saying, I basically sold Netflix on this scene, so I had to get it in there. But it worked. It felt, it set with like the anger and the confusion and the storm, uh-huh, and everything. Excellent. Excellent.
It
stuff.
Really was one of the best horror shows because a horror doesn't lend itself to 8, 9, 10 episodes. I
it
don't
does
think.
Not.
And I liked how Flanagan was able to tie in there was like family drama that I cared about, which is not always the case in,
yep,
horror. It's usually, that's just like barely, it's barely in there and hardly weaved the way it should be. But he did a great job of actually saying, I was interested in the characters.
I love too that any second of that show could you could descend into screaming horror if you noticed one of the many hidden ghosts, right? Because there's ghosts in almost any scene, every scene.
I got so into that too.
It was great, so, and it was great because it felt extremely unnerving, and it fit thematically with the house being sick. And I think not every episode was knock it out of the park, but a lot of the big money Netflix series had just seemed to have way more episodes than they had plot to fill.
For sure, yeah.
So this would
be a gripe.
It killed every single one of the Marvel shows.
Yes.
It made it feel like a chore to watch them. This one, I think it was tight. So I'm a little concerned about Bly Manor, though. I'm interested to see what you're going to think because I've been reading I'm pretty excited for it. I was hoping it'd be good. I've liked Mike Flanagan's, a lot of his other stuff. Did you ever see Oculus?
No.
That's a nice, tight little horror movie. I'd say that one's worth tracking down. I think it was on Netflix for a while. But the reviews have been a little weak on this one. And I also love The Turn of the Screw, right? It's one of my, mm-hmm, favorite ghost stories.
That's, of course, is where he's adapting some of the story, The Turn of the Screw, for The Haunting of Bly Manor. It seems like loose adaptations because
absolutely
Haunting a Hill House was based on the Shirley Jackson novel. And I mean,
I was utterly fine with, by the way, I should say I was utterly fine with how loose the adaptation was. I mean, you could have, you know, it's like The Haunting of Hill House was almost based on the idea of haunted house novels more than it was based on anything in particular, I think.
It really was. It had so little to do with it.
Yeah, it really
this one
did.
Seems to be a little bit more into The Turn of the Screw, perhaps. Maybe, yeah,
I mean, there's
a
governess, right?
Well, There's something going on. I watched the first episode and I thought it was a very good setup episode. Very good.
I will be watching this.
All right.
I'm worried about it, but I will be watching it.
I'm glad it's back. It's perfect for October viewing, and hopefully this one is pretty good too.
I've got to say, I based on some of the reviews, it seemed like Flanagan, they're saying maybe he leaned a little too into the melodrama and the sentimentality that sort of sunk the very last episode. But I think at his best, he is a inventive and just smart horror director who has seen. I think he's kind of cool because like he's seen stuff a million times, right? He obviously knows what he's talking about. He's so good at putting like a little twist or spin on it. Yeah. Where it's like something that you've seen a thousand times, but it's like, okay. And he's just good at being unnerving, I think.
I agree, yeah. And it's going to be good for October. If I don't get anything else out of it other than some jump scares and entertainment, I think I count it as a win.
Hey, if something entertains me, I do think it's hard. It's harder than we give folks credit for, right? To make a movie or a TV series. And you know, if they manage to entertain me, that's more than I've ever done in my life. So kudos, you know, if I got some, that's awesome. Like they brought some joy to my life.
Speaking of movies and entertaining, we are also going to talk about Netflix's documentary that's recently on the streaming service, Dick Johnson is Dead. To set it up, what we have here is a very specific, particular documentary from Netflix and filmmaker Kirsten Johnston. Kirsten Johnston is the same Johnson from the title. She's the daughter of Dick Johnson. And so what we have is she directed and co-wrote the film. It's a document about her dad who's in the early stages of dementia. What Kirsten Johnston does in a way is sort of examine the different ways he could die. That was what I had read going in, that it was always in quotation marks. She kills him several times throughout the movie. But if you're adverse to spoilers with documentaries, maybe you should stop around right in here. It is a documentary. And going forward, I think I'll start talking about some specifics in the movie. Her dad, the titular Dick Johnson, of course, is just a good sport about all this. And he plays along with some of these ideas.
He's a mensch. This guy, he just seems great.
He really does. And that I think that without being who he is, this would not have worked. So let's get some general, and then we'll sharpen our pencils and pick out some things we really like. So overall, what'd you think?
I'm going to give this one a thumbs up. You know, it really kind of struck me, and a lot to talk about with this movie, I think. But
there really is.
It kind of struck me on kind of the level of, you know, Roger Ebert once said something like, we don't cry when sad things happen. We cry when characters are good. And there was just kind of a core of somebody who loves her dad, obviously, clearly loves her dad, and is terrified of losing him, and is kind of trying to make that less scary, or to understand it, or to control it in some way by making this movie and staging these different deaths and all that kind of things. And just the absolute like love that Dick Johnson has for his daughter is pretty overwhelming. You know, you kind of watch it and you're almost like, man, like I hope if I have a kid, right, that they talk about me that way. And that I'm so important to them, you know, it's just like a best case scenario.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I'm always kind of, especially when documentary, and this isn't entirely rash, but I'm always like a little suspicious of the impulse to record and film things, I guess. The performative aspects of things, and I don't know why, but I'm always kind of like, you know, how real is this? How real? Yeah. What are we really seeing? You know, how real? I don't know. I thought it was great. There was some stuff that it really makes you think.
To answer that question, I think this was one of the more real documentaries because my read on it was he was unable to really perform, if that makes sense.
I meant more for her.
Okay, expand on that.
Oh, you know, just some scenes like when she was in the closet doing the recording stuff. I don't know why, but I feel suspicious there. And this is, I think this is completely unfair on my part, but that's just my reaction. I don't know why. I don't know. Maybe it is that performative act, but I'm kind of wondering about, like, your impulse is to film this and share it with the world, which is almost exactly, probably it's because that would is almost exactly the opposite of my impulse. It really is an unfair criticism, but I was kind of struck over and over again by, I don't know, like, what's this impulse? What is this motive? Why are we doing, you know, and I was thinking too, and it's almost in a way that, like, I may not necessarily strike me if somebody writes it in a book or something, but there's something about movies and documentaries that makes it feel more like a performance. And I think part of that is foregrounded in the movie, right? They're coming up with different scenarios and all this kind of stuff. So I do think it's something the movie kind of talks about or incorporates, but I just couldn't get over that feeling. That's my own, and it wasn't a barrier to my enjoyment or anything. It was just kind of a little thing in the back of my head. I agree with you, Dick. See, I think what you see is what you get with him.
The initial filming of those scenes of her in the closet doing some voiceover work, I can't account for, obviously. But I will say that they end up tying an ending to the documentary, mm-hmm. which was to me a surprise ending in a way. Mm-hmm. Like I said, we're going to get into spoilers, so if you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about, and we'll go ahead and I'll mention it. Maybe we'll start from the back and work our way to the front of the film. But it ends with her doing one of those voiceovers. And normally, I think the expectation would have been that was it. That you were going to get the... I was honestly bracing myself for the letters on the screen to report that he died.
Me too, man. I mean, too.
I was bracing. But instead, what you have is her doing one of these voiceovers in the closet, and she ends and opens the door, and he's standing there smiling and gives her a hug, and the letters you get on the screen is simply his name and his birth year, and that was it. He hasn't died, at least not in the film he has, and I haven't honestly researched any further. I do know that he is in a facility now. That's about all I know, that he's in a facility that would help him in his latter stages of dementia, more so than she could help, I suppose.
I think, I mean, you know, when folks need round the clock watching so they don't fall or hurt themselves, or you wander out in the traffic or something, right? Like, he was getting to that point at the end of the movie where, you know, he's thinking he's on a secret mission in the middle of the night, things like that. I'll say the thing I think that, because I think this is really for folks that take something like this seriously, I think something that she said that stuck with me, and I do think is one of the questions of the movie, is what does loving demand of us? What does love demand of us? She to be loving. She asks, and she kind of said, which, you know, I think her words are, I'm quoting from, I have a Roger Ebert's review pulled up because I wanted to remember the quote exactly. Kirsten said, "It would be so easy if loving only gave us the beautiful, but loving demands is that we face the fear of losing each other."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a powerful quote.
And I think, you know, kind of one of the, if you're religious or if you're otherwise, right? Like, if you're somebody who believes that you're not just here for yourself, that you're not just here to say what's in it for me, I think one of the central questions of being, if you are that kind of person, is what is loving demand of me? Hmm. And I think, you know, life poses that question. I mean, every time you go to the shelter and pick out a cat, right? You're saying, I'm preparing to be, you hope that one day you will be sad. Because if your animal died and you're like, I'm not sad at all, that cat was a piece of shit, then things went wrong. Every time you meet somebody, you make a friend, we know how this ends. So you're hoping that you're sad because that it means that things were good. If you're not sad, things weren't good. You know, if you're not sad when your spouse dies, something went wrong somewhere. If you're not sad when your parents die, you know, something was broken somewhere. Hmm. And I think that's really kind of at the heart of this, right?
In this movie, come came to me at a very specific time, and it comes to everyone at a specific time, mm-hmm. obviously, for the world. But for me personally, I have done just this almost exhaustive investigative thinking about death. And COVID, of course, helped prompt that. But I was on the cusp of doing it anyway. I am soon to turn 44 at the end of the month. And I just keep thinking, okay, it truly is exhausting. And maybe some of our listeners can relate. But I keep thinking, now that I've got a daughter, a three-year-old daughter, I think, okay, if I live to 76, I'll get to see her turn, blah, 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 blah. Or if I live to, you know, my dad's 77. He just turned 77 earlier this month. And so that means I may could turn 77. Am I going to see Andy turn whatever years old she would be? And I do the math, and I keep one of the big thoughts I had during this movie was, okay, I probably have lived half of my life. What was that like? Is that long enough? Does it seem long? Did I do things? Did I pack it enough? Because is it all downhill from here? Those kinds of thoughts, and I know those sound morbid, and a lot of times they can be, but for me, they're not always morbid. They're more like, okay, what do I need to do between now and 2040 or whatever year it will be?
Sure. Yeah, I think...
But that has a lot more to do with me than the film, though the film did help prompt a lot more of that kind of thinking. And
I mean, I think when, you know, we are really bad about death, right? Like, we're one of the first you know, I go to some of the old houses around here, mm-hmm. and they have usually...
When you say we, do you mean America?
Oh, yeah, America.
Okay.
Or our culture. You know, you can read books about this and that sort of thing, but we're one of the first generations not to really be faced with the reality of death as part of life, right? And, you know, I go to some of the old houses around here. I can, you know, these houses from 1680, 1720, whatever. And they usually have something called a birthing room. And that's where you were born. Because you're not going to the hospital, you know, you can't go to the hospital. And it's also where you may die in that same room too, right? Mm-hmm. It's a house that's set across. It's set so that people don't have to walk through it. But it's, you know, the reality of life. And part of that too is just privacy as we understand it today, and personal space and all that didn't quite exist as much as that time. But, it is kind of like we send old folks, you know, people don't die in their homes. They go somewhere else and die. Mm-hmm. And we don't see it, and we don't take care of people. We're not taking care of people who die, and our society is not really set up to keep you around after a certain amount of years. So I do think, especially when it's as good as this, something that kind of makes you think about dying and those you've lost or haven't lost yet, things like that. I think it's good for us. I don't think it's necessarily morbid. I think it's odd in a certain way. I think we have a lot of people love Halloween, mm-hmm. but I wonder, you know, with all of its attendance, you know, we love that thrill, but then, you know, I don't think you necessarily get something like this from, say, watching a horror. Maybe there you do have a distance and remove instead of the, like, I will die one day, and right. I will be caring for people who are dying one day.
To me, documentaries are often like this game of chance on how good they can be. I think they can be pretty good no matter what, depending on the filmmaker, but I think there are elements that just can't be controlled as well. And in this case, there are two. This one gained like this certain amount of cohesion because some of the scenes were set during a New York Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
And that just worked well with the motifs, of course. But the other factor I briefly mentioned was Dick Johnson is just so sweet and affable, and he has this infectious smile, and you immediately care about this guy. He feels like your dad or your family member immediately.
Absolutely.
He feels like a TV dad. He feels like you're one of your favorite TV dads from whatever sitcom you grew up with or TV show you grew up with. He seems flawless, you know? And it's that's just a strike of luck in a way for Kirsten Johnson, the filmmaker. And then, of course, we get the strike of luck that part of his time with her in New York, she moves him from Seattle to New York early in the film, first 5 minutes. And to have a guy who's so sweet, it seems, and who's so easily relatable.
Yeah.
And it really controls the emotional stakes of this documentary quite well.
I almost got to watching this where I was kind of like, I don't need to see the death vignettes because I just wanted to see more of Dick and his family. You know, what's going on? I wanted to check in with him. You know, some of the scenes were really powerful, right? Like him having his office taken apart, packing up his house, losing his car, you know.
Losing the car thing, yeah.
Yeah, and things that deals with it so well. And he obviously loves his family so much. It's pretty incredible. I got so that I was almost dreading the death vignettes because it's like, this guy's so great. I don't want to see him, you know, trip and fall and hurt himself or...
And they almost become a sidebar. I know going into the movie, I thought that was going to be like a premise, a huge...
Me too.
A huge conceptual kind of thing. And it just ended up almost being very, for lack of a better word, just meta because they weren't just scenes of him dying, but they were scenes of them filming the scenes of him dying. It became very layered. Almost too layered, like you're saying. It almost became like you didn't even need it.
It did. Like, I was thinking of that. Like, there's one scene, you were talking about it being too layered. There's one scene where they're talking to the mic operator.
Yes, the boom sound lady.
And and there's a stunt person with the same jacket as Dick. And she says, every time I see him go down, I think you've gone down. Yeah. And just like we are supposed to, I suppose.
Right. She sort of expresses that for us. I tell you what I found to be the most deeply moving was the footage of her mom.
Oh, man, yeah.
In the throes of, I guess, Alzheimer's. No, they specify. I was about to say they didn't specify, but they do. It's Alzheimer's. And I don't know that I've seen anyone that deep into Alzheimer's on screen. Or in person, honestly. I don't recall.
It sort of runs in my family. So when I was younger... It reminded me of my great grandmother who, but I was pretty young when she died, but she really hardly even knew you were there. But that stuff kind of hit me too, because this year my dad's mom died, my Grammy died, and she was fairly, you know, she wasn't yet 80, but she'd had, I don't remember exactly what it is, but this kind of progressive degenerative disease where it affected her balance. But it was also, you know, it was going on her memory and the words. And she was forgetting things, right? So she was forgetting names and things like that. And you know, she did end up dying this year, and I wasn't able to go to her funeral because of COVID. It was right in the middle of lockdown. There wasn't a funeral. And, you know, it was kind of my last memory of her is a year ago, March, when she was still forgetful. But still really, you know, I saw her and it was great. You know, I walked in and, she says, oh, I remember you, you're the librarian. I would made sure to remember, you know, things like that. And so it was kind of, I didn't see when she really went downhill. So kind of seeing that footage of her mom kind of made me think about, you know, what the stuff I didn't see with my own grandmother.
Yeah. It's, affecting. For sure.
Indeed.
Doesn't she even have to remind her mom to, correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't she have to remind her mom in that footage to keep her eyes open?
Yeah, she's closing her eyes for whatever reason.
Yeah, that's very, it's sad. I think this documentary had one of the best images, just shots, if you will. Which was, and I say best in terms of what it was trying to accomplish. So it was the best shot for the movie that it was making. It's this image of Kirsten holding a camera. She's shooting in New York and a bus comes by and she's herself. She gets a shot of herself holding the camera in the reflection of the bus's windows. And I don't know that I've seen many shots that tell a story as much as that one did for the documentary that she's trying to make, which is, to me, it read as if she's trying to shoot pictures of her dad getting moved in, but it's really a shot of herself. Lots of great shots that in this documentary of expressing loneliness and the loneliness that probably that senility and dementia can have for someone, I suppose. It was a very affecting movie to me, and but I was in the right headspace for it. I can see someone watching this in it and not being as, not leaving it as fulfilled as I did. It was a little slow at times, but it was only 90 minutes, and I felt like it fit with where my headspace is anyway. So
it was the one of the things I loved about this movie is I didn't. There was, I mean, there's real sadness and real pain, but I didn't leave it just feeling like garbage.
Exactly.
It was actually like, surprise, it's a movie about dying and losing, mm-hmm. but also it feels very, does feel up, kind of uplifting.
Yeah. It's a little life affirming. Yeah, times, I think to be so. Cliche there.
Well, I mean, you know, just, we all know how this story is going to end for us.
Yeah.
Every single person, we, you know, whether we like it or not, we know what's going to happen. So why not have some fun with it, you know? Mm-hmm. And people obviously love Dick, and he loves people.
Yeah.
And it's
and chocolate cake.
And chocolate cake. And it was kind of cool.
His affinity for chocolate cake I could really relate to. I'll leave you with one more question to answer.
Sure.
Before we head into break. Did you ever question any of the ethics of her filming and doing this?
You know, she has that thing where she's saying, like, I want to make sure I don't push him too hard because, you know, as the movie progresses, he's, in a way, less and less able to give full consent, fully informed consent, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because years are passing and you know, his memory and cognitive functions, right, are degenerating.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think it's Marta, the woman who's helping care for her father, says, well, you know, he's really doing it because he loves you. And she's right. Like, yeah, I know, and I have to be really careful because I could ask him to do anything. And you know, there was a bit with the blood packet scene where,
yep,
he doesn't seem like he's full 100% there, uh-huh. especially after he's kind of saying, you know, I'm miserable and I'm cold. It's the worst I've felt in my life. And you kind of started to wonder, I don't think we're witnessing like elder abuse or anything like that.
No.
I think that she loves her father very much. And I don't think she would do anything intentionally to harm. I think that at the very least, that was starting to trouble her. When someone will do anything for you, that's you really have to be extra careful.
And I guess that was one of the last sort of setups,
yes,
designed scenes that she put him through. I think
that's the last one. I think that's the last one where he dies, because then we get the bit where he's in the Halloween,
he's at his own
house, you know.
Yep.
In the costume. But that's
that too is that that was I worried about him in that Halloween scene because,
yeah.
Because there's a lot of images that would hurt some or just be bothersome for even a normal person.
I was gonna say I don't want to sound overly infantilizing, but you know, it is almost like I kind of remember being little and not being able to tell the difference between fantasy and reality, that I can't, you know, the way little kids do, right? Things in movies scare them, and
mm-hmm.
and I assume that's a little bit what it's like to be older, right? Like
that's
to
what I've always
lose a
gathered.
Little of that cognitive function, right? So you do kind of worry that, like, you know, kids know that they're just seeing something on TV. They know it's not real, but that doesn't make it not scary. And I kind of wonder if, you know, if maybe one day that's the way I'll feel, right? Things will scare mm-hmm. me in a way that they don't now.
It's an affecting piece of work. It's an interesting piece of work. A little premise heavy, but that premise fades, honestly.
I thought it was good, and I do think it moves at a pretty good clip. You know, it's only 90 minutes. It doesn't overstay its welcome.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the vignettes, maybe I could have done a little without.
Yeah.
But I think overall, it moves at a real good clip, and this is a winner. It's a good one.
That is true. I agree with your take there. So, that's it, Donovan. We're gonna. I'm gonna shift into a conversation with Adam. After that, I'm gonna go let Andy watch The Exorcist because.
Well, it's time she's what, three now? It's time she learns.
She's three. Yeah. It's a Halloween tradition.
It's time she learns.
All right, folks. We'll go into our break, and on the other side, we're gonna talk a little bit about the Apple TV show Ted Lasso. Hey, there are no ads on the Alabama Taken. There are no ads here on Taking It Down either. But we'd love to have your help if you're so willing. Visit buymeacoffee.com/thealabamatake, where you can make a donation of any amount to help with the cost of the website and podcast hosting. Anyone interested in writing or podcasting or producing for the Alabama Take, we welcome all ideas. Messages, let us know. Lastly, make sure to subscribe to us, our podcast, using your app, and then rate us on there as well. It helps a lot. We'll get back into the discussion. So, bringing in Adam. Adam, you were gone. You were gone for some drive-by truckers and some Dick Johnson is dead discussion.
I hated to miss it. I hated to miss the having the whole crew together. I can't wait to hear you guys' discussion. But yeah, I left basically my block for the first time. Well, second time since the old COVID started. So it was good. I drove just about the length of the state of Alabama. So I feel ready to take on our great state.
You're seeped in Alabama. Is that what you're telling me?
I got it coming out my pores right now. I basically drove from Coffee County all the way back to Florence by way of Tuscaloosa. So I've seen the length and nearly the width of it. To go from traveling so much last year to like not at all this year, even going somewhere as unexotic as South Alabama was like, just thank God I'm on the road and listening to music and fields are passing by.
I've got a stack of podcasts because I don't go anywhere or do very much. That's when I listen to a lot of podcasts, or is on the road, or exercising even sometimes, but I haven't done much of either. Thanks, COVID, you know.
Did y'all already touched on COVID, right?
We touched on COVID. Do you have COVID thoughts?
No, not really. it's still here. Kind of a letdown, to be honest.
The only thing I can add, I guess, from earlier is I swear I wake up about every other day and think I have it. That's about all I can say.
Yeah.
I think it's allergies, honestly. I just wake thinking, well, I've got it today.
Today's the day.
You and I are here to talk about a surprise. To me, it's a surprise. And I think every review you'll read online, it talks about how surprising this show is. We're talking Ted Lasso. And if you're not familiar with it, it is a Apple TV Plus show original. It's based around these ads from 3 or 4 years ago where Jason Sudeikis, the SNL alum, played Ted Lasso in these advertisements because NBC had just gotten the Premier League on NBC Universal and their network. And you're probably a lot more familiar with those commercials. I remember seeing them very briefly during like NFL games. They probably caught your eye more so. You want to...
It did. It was just a goofy campaign that, you know, when they got the rights to the Premier League, coverage for soccer changed so much. Like it went from digging around on the internet and finding some like illegal stream to watch games every weekend to, you know, you could just watch anything either on TV or online as, you know, Rokus and Fire Sticks and all that kind of evolved. But there was kind of like a push, like find your Premier League team, like trying to get Americans to care about soccer and get some emotional skin in the game, so to speak. And Ted Lasso was definitely a part of that. And the character then was more charming than I thought it was going to be already, because it seems like a dumb kind of arrogant American posture to take about this sport that is the biggest thing on the planet, right? It's like, well, we'll Americanize this.
And what we have is Ted Lasso. In the commercial and the show, Ted Lasso is an American football coach who gets hired to manage, coach. And I'll be the Ted Lasso in this conversation because I won't know the terms. But that's why you're here. But Ted Lasso is hired to coach and or manage a Premier League soccer team. Same thing in the Apple TV show. So here we have a show that really shouldn't work as it's solely based on a commercial for soccer.
When I heard that they were coming out with the show, I had no interest in watching it at all.
Yeah. Yeah, me either. I didn't think anything about it, honestly. I don't even know if I had the thought, I'm not going to watch that. I don't think I had a thought about it.
Yeah, it wasn't on my radar, but as more and more people kept texting me that I would not expect to really like this show. I thought it was going to be just kind of a goofy, maybe fun, but not really substantial in any way. But people kept texting me, and it kept getting really, really good reviews. All of the Twitter chatter was very positive. And of course, they timed it with the start of the new season, new soccer season. But I don't know, what have you made of it as an outsider to, you don't care about the Premier League aspect of it, right? Like, you're just kind of in it for the TV show.
Exactly. I know nothing about Premier League. Yeah, I mean, I might could name two teams if you pressed me. I think I could name what, Man United and Man City, or that two? Is that,
yeah,
two?
Yeah, that's two of them. Yeah. You stayed one city. That's smart.
And Crystal Palace, isn't that one?
That is one.
Okay, so I know that one because of the show. But Ted Lasso coaches at a fictional one. Is that right? I just read that today, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't have known Richmond was a fictional one. But anyway, yeah, so coming in, I was just in it for the show. Jason Sudeikis was a great SNL alum, I think. I like him just fine. So he was a draw to me once I figured out that this has some wheels under it. And I decided, I'd seen a few people talking about it online. I'd seen a review, I think, or a headline of a review that was praising it. And I put it on my list around that time, and then I found out you were watching it, and I decided, okay, I could probably watch several of these, and we could talk about this, because they're only 30 minutes, and I already had Apple TV, and I found it just, I'll get into the specifics of why, but I found it fine, absolutely fine, like, really nothing wrong with it as far as a sitcom would go.
Yeah, I've really been enjoying it, and I think we'll probably end up saying close to the same thing, that, you know, we've already established that it was unexpected, the enjoyment level, and it immediately hits you how wholesome and kind of just happy-go-lucky it is. Like, it is a ray of sunshine in a pretty shitty year. When it started, I kind of wondered if that's why people were enjoying it so much, that it was just like, mm-hmm, such a shot in the arm of goodness. But I think as it went on, you know, the whole thing's out now, so we can talk about it as a complete storyline. I know you haven't finished it. As it started to get into a little bit more complexity, it handled it well, which I was kind of, I thought that would probably be shaky if they tried to take a serious turn outside of making the point that goodness is, goodness can win, right? Like, that doesn't happen, mm-hmm, a lot in our media, that just someone who is easy to forgive comes out on top. I don't know. What was your initial impression through the first few episodes? Was it kind of, this is borderline cheesy? This is...
Yeah, I did think that. I thought it was a, you know, BuzzFeed called it a warm hug. That feels right. I thought it was almost cheesy. It's really weird. And I really had racked my brain for this conversation, because I'm trying to figure out how it does saccharine without being annoying. And I think I pinpointed one thing, and you can add to this. There's this underlying sadness, I think, that's never, at least in the first four episodes that I've seen, it's never talked about, but it's, you know, it's there. You feel it, even if they did. And they allude to it so briefly. Ted Lasso does the most alluding to it. And Rebecca, the club owner, she's sort of inherited through a divorce. And it's basically, the premise is Major League, right? She wants the soccer club. Am I calling it a club? Is that right?
Club, yeah.
So she wants the soccer club to fail because her ex-husband is a philandering piece of shit. And she kind of wants to get a dig in at him. And she hires this American football coach. He actually coached at Wichita State. And do they really have a football team? I know they're a great basketball team.
I'm looking at it. It looks like they do. The Shockers.
Right. You know, Alabama played them a couple years in basketball.
They don't anymore.
They don't have a football team anymore?
Not since 1986.
Not since Ted Lasso left.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's the premise of Major League. That part and the fact that it developed from a commercial is really the low points of the show so far, four episodes in.
That's the low point. The storyline with her husband, you think, is one of the lows?
I think the premise is borrowed from Major League is a low point. The fact, no, its development on screen is perfectly fine.
Okay, I got you. I think one of the things that really makes this work, you know, you talking about the premise is kind of borrowed and I think just like in lesser hands, the Ted Lasso character would be kind of one-dimensional, and his wholesomeness would be cheesy instead of funny, or instead of like the warm hug that you mentioned. If Rebecca, the owner, if that wasn't a strong performance, I think her, you know, she's just kind of riding that line between being surrounded by good people and wanting to do bad things, kind of being pulled at by that, and clearly kind of being out of her usual way of existing, like what this divorce has done to her. But they don't really dwell on all of that. I mean, they talk about her efforts to kind of sabotage a team, but they don't really get into, especially early on, the emotional heaviness of it. And but they hint at all these things so well early. So I think that is, it's a credit to the acting that that's able to be pulled off.
And the writing, because you're right, they could totally steer into how she's just, or they could make her into this just crooked, hell-bent lady who's just going to get revenge at all costs. But instead, she'll start to do something, and Ted Lasso or one of the players has a nice moment with her, or one of the players' girlfriends actually has a big role in the first four episodes.
Yeah, Keely.
And that kind of... Keely, and then that brings her out of her anger, and also kind of helps her be a little more wholesome than she would have been. So unlike, I guess, Major League, she is affected in a positive way by the other characters. And, you know, they could have examined how divorce makes people angry and how you want to get revenge, but instead she kind of wants to better herself at times.
Yeah, she's... Everybody's recovering from something, it seems like. I don't know. They do it so well. I don't want to spoil too much for you going forward. But again, they take what could be a simple thing. A woman wants to ruin football club. It comes out of a commercial, blah, blah, blah. And they give it just this emotional weight and resonance. Because again, I thought people were just enjoying that it was a break from the year 2020. And I don't know that it's...
Yeah.
It may make a year-end list for me. I don't know. I don't know how long this
wow.
The show is sustainable. It may be a great one season. I don't know if they'll do a season two, but...
No, it just got signed. It just got announced for season
two. Oh, wow. Well, that's great. It's interesting to me that these... Even before this crappy year or the Trump administration or the kind of the current version of America, the turn towards like a Parks and Rec is the biggest example that I can think of likable people who kind of want the best for each other. I know that's not really the driving plot factor in this, but it's interesting. I've heard songwriters say they only write sad songs when they're happy, and that stuff like that, you know, like that you kind of, how TV reacts to society and what's going on around it. This is a pretty fascinating show on that front, especially because mm-hmm. of the just variety of people who texted me and said, you have to watch this show. And I don't think it was just because they were like, oh, that's my friend that watches the Premier League. I think they really, really dug the show.
Not to overanalyze, but you kind of got into it just then. So you think this would get the raves it's gotten if outside of a pandemic or such an awful administration, negative vibes floating from our government and stuff like that?
That's an interesting question, because it's definitely a balm of sorts. To what's going on. I think it probably would. I don't think it would have... The people that watched it, I think, would have loved it. I don't know that as many would have watched it. I think people tuned in because they saw it on Twitter or something and just got that warm hug and kept on watching. So I do think it would have had a very devoted following, but I don't know, maybe it's tied to Apple. Apple TV is kind of a new concept. I would think this is one of the first big, heavily promoted shows they've done, or at least among the first, right?
Well, no. You know, they started this time last year, November of last year, and they had the morning show with Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston and Steve Carell. And then they had... I've had a few shows since.
But they're still in the first year of trying to convince people to sign up. And I think this is maybe an easy sell of...
Yeah.
Like, not a hard-hitting, you know, Netflix and all these places kind of use their hard-hitting documentaries or series or whatever, and... This is just good, clean fun.
What do you make of Apple TV Plus? You know, you guys, didn't you sign on just to watch this show and you're kind of doing like a free test run?
You get 7 days, so I think I'll have a few left when I sit down tonight. So we're going to poke around and see what's going on. The interface is very pleasing to use. Like, we've enjoyed, which is kind of the opposite of some of the other programs. You tune in and it's easy. I don't know. I've dug it. I need to find other things that are exclusive to it and do some digging. What do you recommend?
Little America is fantastic. An anthology series, 30-minute episodes, each episode about how an immigrant has come to America. And it's so moving without being melodramatic. It's so good.
Is it going to make me happy like Ted Lasso?
Yeah, it will. Okay. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep. Get a lot of that flavor. I recommend Servant, which is, I feel like, maybe their best show. No, Little America was probably their best show, but I recommend Servant, which is a M. Night Shyamalan series, very dark and mysterious in an M. Night Shyamalan way, involving a baby and a nanny, but I do...
And a twist.
There's twists. There are more than one twist in that.
That's
one.
And classic Shyamalan.
Or one of the stars is—he's more of a co-star. Is one of the Harry Potter guys? What's the redheaded guy's name? Ron Weasley.
Yeah, Rupert Grint is in it.
Him.
Yeah,
he's in it.
Okay, I think I knew that.
He plays a very against type guy in that show, but I really enjoyed that one. It was a weekly show, and I think I watched it every Friday that it was released because I found it that entertaining.
Appointment viewing.
I have one Ted Lasso related question for you, since you've seen almost all of the episodes. Ted Lasso is, though he does have this underlying melancholy that you get a brief glimpse of, does he become more than two-dimensional going forward?
Yeah, he definitely does. Okay. There's plot elements that happen that kind of force everyone to develop a bit more depth. You know, like the Roy Kent character that is just always angry, and I think he's a funny character at the start, but you kind of know exactly what he's going to do.
Yes. It's predictable.
Yeah. But all of these people, they go through emotional growth. Seems to be the point, that Ted has this wake of positivity that impacts their lives. But he goes through some melancholy moments for sure.
After the first four episodes, I'm really ready for his character to blow up or go off or coach in a way, much like I always assumed college football coaches do at some point, even the most positive ones.
He's a very kind college football coach, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. All right, so Ted Lasso gets a recommendation from us. I'm interested to hear, maybe we can get a line or two from you next week if you've checked out Little America, because I think that was out in January, but very good show.
No, I'm in. That premise seems like Ted Lasso is a obviously fictional kind of fantastical warm hug. Little America sounds like a real life one. So that's in the weeks leading up to November 3rd, I will take all of those that I can get.
Really goes hand in hand with Immigration Nation. If you've watched that and then that's leaving you bummed, there are hopeful stories beyond.
Yeah, I'd love to hear a few.
All right. That's all we have for this week. We appreciate you listening. And we want to remind you to join in on our upcoming Book Club episode on October 27th. And we're going to be talking about The Only Good Indians. That's it for this week. We'll talk to you next week.